All right, this is Julia Greider, and I am with Catherine L. Baronic in the Roanoke College Library on January 17th, 2017, for her oral history. So, to start out, just tell me a little bit about when you were born and where you were born and a little about your childhood.
Okay. I was born on Thanksgiving Day in 1953. My mother was thrilled because she didn't have to eat my grandmother's dressing. I'm the oldest of five kids. We were raised kind of middle class to lower middle class. Raised Catholic, went to St. Sebastian's grade school, and a couple years of Catholic high school. Ultimately, I dropped out of high school and went to a free school called Milwaukee Independent School, which was formed by a handful of students from around the Milwaukee area and some educators from the University of Wisconsin. So I went there for the last year and a half of my schooling, and they had something worked out with the colleges that they would accept our graduates, since we really weren't graduating, we're just leaving. So then I was a theater major for about a year and a half and realized, okay, I'm not going to be an actress. This isn't going to work out. And decided I wanted to go into television production to help change the way women were portrayed on TV. So I signed up for the telecasting course at Milwaukee Area Technical College. And I entered there in 1974. It was a two-year program. And I graduated with honors in 1976 from the telecasting program. And while I was there, I worked for the public station, which the school owned on a part-time basis, as well as the local NBC affiliate. And every job that I've had, starting with those two, I was the first woman that they had hired in that position. And so not the first woman in the universe or the world or the state or the country, but at that particular institution. And so it really set the stage for my career, because that continued throughout my career, that I was always the first woman that they had hired in that role. So I was constantly proving myself and always having to be 150%, you know, rather than just 100%, whatever. So I graduated in 1976, and I took a trip across the country interviewing at different stations, and where I stopped on this trip was based on where I knew people so I could stay for free. I got an Amtrak pass and took the train. And so what I didn't know at the time was that nobody needed to hire somebody as green as I was for a director's job, which is what I wanted. And they didn't need to hire somebody from out of state for a production assistant job, which I didn't really want anyway. So needless to say, I had a great trip, but I never got a job from that. So next I sent out 75 resumes, and for some reason I decided I wanted to live in the Southeast. So I sent out 75 resumes and got a call from a station in Roanoke. And they flew me down for an interview. It was WSLS. And I was offered the job. And so I went back to Milwaukee and packed up my stuff and moved down here. I was 23 years old. I was a producer-director, just what I wanted to do. And there's one particular engineer at the station who was just aghast that they would bring a woman in. And so he took a week's vacation my first week on the job. And then he came back, and of course the first week I just observed. I didn't do anything. So my first week on the job was his week back from vacation, and that was I got a good laugh out of that, because he was just a jerk throughout my tenure there. So they paid, they didn't pay very well. I remember that I started out at $7,200 a year, and in order to have enough money to live, I also took a job waitressing at a new restaurant in town. It had just opened, called McAdoo's. And so I would do that. I'd like work the lunches and then go change clothes and go in and direct the 6 and 11 o'clock newscasts. And in between the newscasts, we'd do other programming. So there would be church shows and various public service stuff. I did some commercials. But my favorite was doing these church shows that would air on Sundays, and they would always send their youth director in to talk to me and, you know, try and get me to come to their church. And all I would have to say, really, was that I had been raised Catholic, and that would usually shut them up. And so that was that. And I was also, I was out as a lesbian, not out to the world. I, you know, was a practicing lesbian at the time, and had a really hard time, you know, finding women. And there really weren't any bars at the time. And I remember I wrote a letter to a friend of mine in Detroit, and I said, the only thing I know that I said about it was that I'm really having trouble finding women. There's got to be women around here. I mean, there was nothing salacious in it. There's nothing about sex. I mean, nothing. All, that was basically what I said. Well, because I was 23 and really dope, I wrote it on company stationery. And the letter came back. For some reason, my friend didn't get it, and the letter was sent back. And so the upper office people opened it, and the woman who saw it was appalled, and she left it in the women's bathroom so other people would see it. And I found this out years later. I had no idea. But so as hard as I was trying to not be a lesbian, well, not be a lesbian, but to look straight and act straight and not have that come up, they already knew, which kind of cracks me up.
So how did they respond to that?
Well, I, because I didn't know that they knew, I couldn't tell. But I was friends with a reporter there, and she told me years later. That's how I found out. And so even though we were friends, every now and then it was probably a little weird. Because again, this was 77. And so it happened sometime between 77 and 80 that happened. But it didn't really affect anything. I finally, you know, came to me, oh, if I want to meet women, softball field. And so that's what I did, is I found a women's softball in Roanoke, and they would play at Salem Field, and I went and I would take pictures, and la, la, la. And next thing you know, I was dating the pitcher. And then I ultimately met my best friend of many years, and she was, you know, dating, you know, a second baseman or something, I don't know. But we would sit on the hill at Salem Field and just get drunk and cheer. And it was a great time. But it was all about just sitting and watching sports. And most of the softball players were totally closeted. I mean, I think they probably all were, actually. And so they were almost flaunting it to have their girlfriends come, because then other players would think that, oh, yeah, she's a dyke. You know? So, but I didn't care, because here I was, this Yankee, coming down here, and I just had a different attitude about it, you know. And I thought everybody should be out and as happy about being gay as I was. And then there was also the bowling leagues, which I would sometimes go and watch them bowl. It was funny, because I was talking about my pitcher girlfriend. We'll call her D. And D owned a 1976 Cutlass Supreme Black. Loved that car. She loved that car. And it was the last year that they were allowed to make the big cars. So this was a big prize for her. And we had very little in common, and she was older. She was 30. And nonetheless, we dated for a while, and I can remember one day we were in the car, and she took my hand and sang along with the radio, Three Times a Lady, and I thought, oh my God, what has happened to me? Where am I? I ain't no lady. It was pretty funny. Anyway, that relationship didn't last. And so then I started dating an outfielder. And that lasted for a while, you know, maybe 3 years. Then I'd gotten a crush on a different ball player. And she was from Danville. And I had gone to a tournament in Danville with my outfielder. And I remember the moment when I saw this woman, and it was like the world stopped. I mean, I've never experienced that before or since, where everything went away except here was this woman running in from the field all dirty and dusty and stuff. And I was like, who was that? I want to date someone like her. And I didn't know how to make that happen. She was in Danville. And so I, you know, asked around, found out who she was. And then I was asked to do a show for Channel 10 about the Roanoke Park system. So I did my research and stuff, and I, you know, went around and I shot. And because at that point I was a one-woman band. I shot, I edited, I wrote it, I directed it. That was it. Nobody usually was with me. And what I, in my research, I discovered that there was a very beautiful park in Danville. So I went to Danville for the shoot, and I contacted her, and I said, oh, I'm going to be in Danville on the shoot. Would you like to meet for lunch? Well, because I was making $7,200 a year, well, the next year I was making $7,600 a year. When I left there, I was making $8,100. I mean, it was, it's unbelievable. I mean, cost of living was less, but still. So I get down there, we meet for lunch, and I don't have a cent. So I had to kind of cop to that, and she was stunned because she was a teacher and she didn't make much money either. But she was like, well, okay. And nothing happened after that, basically. And then, I don't know how this goes. We finally got together. But because of that, that show, the park show, the chief photographer at WDBJ7 saw it and was and needed a photographer, and they were like, wow, who shot that? It's beautiful. Thank you very much. And they contacted me, and I had to make a decision if I wanted to move over to the good station, because at the time it was clear-cut that DBJ7 was the best, for excuse me, a lesser job, or stay at Channel 10. And I took the job and went over there, and it was really fun because being a news photographer, you're in the thick of it. And so there was a big murder trial, for example, and Keith Humphrey's picture was on the front page of the paper talking to, you know, trying to get a soundbite from the guy, and you could see my arm holding the camera lens. I was like, that's me. It was great. And there were just lots of cool moments during that time. So I started in September of 1980, and in January of 1981, on Super Bowl Sunday, I was coming back from a story at Smith Mountain Lake with a reporter and had a really bad car accident. I plowed into a tree and took down a mailbox, and it was on a country road in Bedford County, and it was pretty bad. The reporter braced herself on the windshield, and her arm got all cut up, and I kind of jammed on the floorboard with my left foot as if that was going to stop anything. But my my hip bone was destroyed, just got slammed into my pelvis. So I was in the hospital for 3 months, and during that time, all of my buddies would come see me. And so it would be like this big lesbian party in the hospital. My aunt, who was a lesbian and my favorite person in the world, was visiting from Arkansas once, and she brought a case of champagne in. So the next morning, the nurses come in, and I'm like, I'm over in the bed, and there's just empty champagne bottles everywhere, but we had had a really good time. My sister came to visit me from Milwaukee, and so she and my friends wheeled me out of the hospital into Elmwood Park, and Keith Humphrey coming up again, he came to visit on his motorcycle, and so I've got pictures of me lying on a gurney with a bunch of lesbians ignoring me because Keith Humphrey was there talking to me because we weren't out. And so it was really hard because people from Channel 7 would come see me, and all my lesbian friends would come see me, and so it was like the worlds would collide, and I still wasn't out. But it became apparent to people who got it or who were kind of smart. But still, it's like 1981, and So after that, I was still off work for months and months, and I was on crutches for a year or two. And during that 3-month period, I had 3 or 4 surgeries. It was a whole ordeal. And while we would all be visiting over my hospital bed, community started developing a lot. And it was just a continuation of what was going on at the Taylor House and everything. But there are some of us who really bonded in the hospital like that. And that's not where the genesis of First Friday was, but it certainly was a big part. I think, like, Brahoni had just started coming to... A woman just started coming to Roanoke, and she was seeing one of my friends, and they would come visit me a lot, and everything just started to coalesce there beyond beyond the softball field or Taylor House or whatever. So that was when I got out of there. It was May of 81, and then Barbara Waldron, somebody else, she's cool with me saying this, she turned 50 in November, and that was really one of our first big events was Barbara Waldron's surprise 50th birthday party. And that's that.
So I'm just going to backtrack a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Tell me a little bit more about, like, growing up and, like, what was your relationship like with your family, and how did you feel about school? How did you fit in? Stuff like that.
Well, I wasn't part of the, what I considered the in group in grade school, because I lived on one side of 55th Street, and they all lived on the other side of it. They were all, like, on 50th Street. There was just this neighborhood that a lot of the girls lived in, and they were all really good friends. So it's not that they necessarily excluded me, but I just wasn't, just proximity-wise, wasn't part of that. And so I had a best friend who lived near me, and I absolutely adored her. And she would do things like, if I had a crush on a boy, she would get him to like her. So she was horrible. She was just horrible. But, you know, I was blinded, you know. And there was nothing sexual about our friendship or anything like that. And her parents actually couldn't stand me because her dad was the president of the John Birch Society in Milwaukee. And, and I was not of the same economic class as they were. And I don't know, whatever. So when it came time for high school, we went to different high schools. But a lot of the group of 50th Street girls ended up going to Divine Savior, where I was, too. And I don't know. I mean, it was fine. I was homeroom president sophomore year. And, so I was doing okay, but I was not, one of the main people. It was an all-girls school. So I also was on financial aid, so I had to do things like clean the blackboards, and the erasers and stuff. So I couldn't take the school bus, so I would have to take the city bus. So that kind of kept me separate from people, too. I had friends, but it wasn't... High school was not that great for me. Well, after the 2 years, I think it probably had a lot to do with finances, but I'm not positive. But anyway, I left Divine Savior and was going to go to a public school, but I didn't want to go to the public school that I was supposed to go to because it was kind of tougher, greasers and stuff. So there was Wauwatosa East was closer to me, but I lived on 59th Street, and 60th Street was the deadline, was the cutoff. But my original best friend was going there, so I totally wanted to go there. So I gave a fake address, a woman in our parish who was obese, literally obese, and so I would have to clean her kitchen and do whatever she told me to do in order to use her address. So after a semester of doing that, and it was just horrid, a postal deliverer saw my name on a piece of mail to this woman's address and said, wait a minute, she doesn't live here, and sent it back, and that clued the school in, so I was going to get kicked out anyway, but I left to go to Milwaukee Independent School. And that was just a bunch of hippies. I mean, we were we were located in a number of places, but the first one was an old house in sort of an industrial area, and we were fixing the house up. So we were, you know, scraping paint and, you know, doing stuff to make it habitable. And the school was such that if I, say, wanted to take Spanish, there was a Rolodex of people who had volunteered to teach things. So I would look at somebody to teach Spanish. I would see if anybody else wanted to learn it, and then we would set up a time. So it was, of the many things I didn't learn, the things that I did learn at that school were self-reliance and how to make things happen for yourself. And so the school moved around a little bit, and we ended up in close to downtown Milwaukee, and for theater class, we called somebody who was at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, and a young actress who was there said, oh, I'll teach acting, and she came and she taught us, and a few years later, I was watching television, and I saw her on there on a soap opera, and she went on to have a very illustrious career. Judith Light is her name. She's on Transparent now. She's had a huge career, and so that was pretty cool. I ran into her once in L.A. and introduced myself and said, you probably don't remember me, but you're probably going to remember this. I went to MIS, and you taught theater there. And she lit up, and her husband said, oh, my gosh, she's told me all about this. It was really a real cool moment. Anyway, I'm skipping ahead. So that high school, I wanted to continue in theater, and so we could take classes at the university, and so I did that, and met a guy named Wiley. I never really had any boyfriends or dated any guys, and he was a freshman, and I kind of got in with him and his friends, and so he and I dated for a while, but because I was Catholic and frankly not into intercourse, I don't think. I didn't know for sure. I wouldn't go all the way. And so he turned to other people for that. And so the relationship ended. But it was kind of, you know, on and off for, you know, 2 or 3 years. And by that point, I was in college, and I was a member of a women's theater group, and I was also working with some feminists in Milwaukee. We had a newsletter called The Amazon, and it was great. And it was clear, you know, that I was a lesbian. I mean, in my head, I just hadn't made that happen yet. And I was real involved with the just the political movement at the time, and so there was like a lot of, there was the food co-op and the babysitting co-op and the children's co-op. And the children's co-op were all these young families that provided daycare for each other, and you know, they had a whole thing worked out. Well, I remember I went to one of their picnics, and I was like the only one there who wasn't one of the parents, and it was because the two women who did Amazon had kids, and they were, you know, anyway, so it was just, it was all one big happy little political group. Yeah, and then eventually I came out, you know, during that period, and then started going to school for telecasting. And at that point, I was living on Newhall, and that's all you had to say was Newhall, because that we had this very notorious lesbian upper flat that I came out in the second wave of it, and I took over a bedroom of a woman who was moving to San Francisco, and she eventually had a baby with a turkey baster. She was one of the original lesbian moms via turkey baster. And that was in 1976, so that was pretty cool. But anyway, so I moved into Newhall, and we had parties, it was what you do in college, you know, and
so this was like a dorm, or
no?
Okay.
No. It was there was a street, Newhall Street,
okay.
And this was just a duplex.
Okay.
So we lived upstairs, and a lot of pot smoking and drinking and just being happy. Now I was really the only student there, though, so they'd all be partying and I'd be in my room studying, because I was determined that I was going to get the heck out of Milwaukee and I was going to be a producer director, and I did it. And then I was here. You asked me about my family. I had a really beautiful mother, and all she wanted was to be a mother, but she didn't really have mothering skills. So she had 5 kids, and I always felt like we were accessories. And I was never the daughter she wanted or something. I mean, I was not into, wearing a lot of makeup, or, I didn't shave my armpits. She was appalled. And, so we were not that close. For sure. And I think I was closer to my dad. We're both Sagittarians, and I just was always closer to him. But not like he would show me how to fix a car. It's, I could care less. Whereas, like, I do know how to sew and stuff for my mom. I'm Slovenian, and the Slovenians weren't very active in Milwaukee, but the Croatians were. And so my mother got us, my sister and I, into the American Croatian Silver Strings Tamburica Orchestra. And so from 7th grade through high school, I played this Yugoslavian instrument and wore the costumes and sang the songs and did the dances, and we performed all over. And then we were also in Plava Jadran, the Croatian dance group. And my mother was in that too. So despite the fact that she was doing it too, I was involved. It was really a lot of fun, actually. I really respect cultures that are trying to continue their cultural backgrounds while in this country or elsewhere, I guess.
So, when and how did you first realize you were a lesbian?
I came out as a lesbian feminist. I mean, my feminism had a lot to do with when I came out, I think I always would have come out, but I was just more aware of it and not as afraid of it as, like, when I was in high school before I was really involved with feminism. Like, when I was 15 and 16, I had summer jobs in Illinois and in the suburbs as a mother's helper, and so I would watch rich people's kids, and live there and stuff. And I can remember going to, it's called Ravinia, and it's like Wolf Trap or something, but it's in the Chicago area, and to see Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And a woman came up to me, and she had a rainbow pin on or something, and asked me for a light. And I was mortified. So at 15 and 16, I was not at all comfortable with, really, with any sexuality. I wasn't a sexual being at all, but that scared me. On the other hand, when I'd be babysitting in Milwaukee for families, I would, as soon as the kids were in bed, I'd go looking for the Playboys. I didn't know why I liked looking at them, but it just made me feel good. It took me years to put that all together. it really was when I was working on Amazon and in the Milwaukee Women's Theater Group, where it was, I had a crush on one of the other members, but she was straight and stuff. And there was a woman in Milwaukee who kind of, as her duty, she felt it was her duty, she would bring out young lesbians who needed to be brought out. And I was a notch on her belt. She was seeing somebody else. I mean, it was, and I knew that, and I knew that it wasn't going to go anywhere, but I was so in love with her at the time. And it wasn't a very happy experience, but at least that was over with, you know. And I don't know what year that was. I think it was about 20. So maybe 73, 72, or 74. You know. I don't know.
So how did you first get exposed to feminism then?
Oh, well, it was just happening around me, you know. At Milwaukee Independent School, we would go to protests against the war, Women's Lib. You know, the gay rights movement was starting to happen. The Black Power movement. It was everywhere. And I just was always a woman's libber. You know, I mean, in high school, I had the pin with the fist in it, the woman's hat with the fist. And it spoke to me. And again, it wasn't in reaction to my mom, but you know, she was a high femme, and I wasn't, and I was sort of repulsed by it, and didn't want to be anything like her. And even when she would come to visit me in Roanoke, and a bunch of us would be out to eat, and she'd be flirting with the waiters, oh God, it just like stop it. But she needed that, I guess. She needed. So that then I came out and had a couple of little bitty relationships in Milwaukee, maybe because I knew that I was getting out of there. I don't know. It wasn't, my first real long-term relationship was with the Danville softball player. And that lasted 9 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I think you mentioned that your aunt was gay. How did that affect you?
Well, it was interesting because of who she was. She was an artist and she was bohemian. And my mother's family was not your typical family. Like the father left when my mom was three, so she thought that she was told her father had died when she was three, and her mother was struggling. She had three kids, and my mom was the youngest, and so she had the kids in a home for children. And she got a job there doing laundry. And so my mother would go down and visit her in the laundry room, sneak down and visit her, and so she could spend time with her mother. And when my mom was 14, my grandmother died. So then my mother went and lived with a friend of hers through, finished high school, and then met my dad. This was in Fort Worth, Texas, and my dad was in the Air Force down there. So they met and got married when she was barely 18. And she was 19 when she had me. I mean, she didn't know what the heck she was doing, and she was unmothered. And so, I understand it on an intellectual level, but still emotionally it's hard. My aunt, I can remember when we were growing up, one of my brothers or sisters called another one queer. And none of us knew what that meant. But my mother she overreacted. We do not use that word in this house. That is not a word we use. Okay. Well, it took me years to figure it out, but she was kind of protecting her older sister, who I met, I think, for the first time when I was about five. And, oh God, I just loved her. And then didn't see her again until I was maybe in high school. When I was 13, we took a train trip. She lived in Denver, and we took a train out there, the whole family, and saw her there. And then later, I visited her a couple of times. And one of those times, I must have been right out of high school or something, but I came to visit her, and they had tickets to go see Bette Midler. and at Red Rocks, which was this, it's this great outdoor amphitheater in Colorado. It's just gorgeous. And they had an extra ticket, and I got to go, and so everybody was gathered at my aunt's house, and two of the people who were there was a woman about my age, so, you know, like a teenager, and then this older woman who was her coach. I started putting it together then, and I wasn't out yet, but I was, you know, older now and kind of getting it, and we all went to this concert, and it was just gay people. I mean, it was just this huge gay concert, and it was so much fun, but I was just exposed to all these gay men, and, you know, just, I was with a bunch of dykes, and it was just, it was great, but never talked about. And so when I, but that was when I finally started putting it together that my aunt was a lesbian, and so when I did come out, I remember writing her a letter and saying, oh, la, 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 this and that, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, oh, and I came out, and blah, blah, blah. And I just, like, buried it. I buried the lead, totally. And we laughed about it since. She passed away a couple years ago, but she was something else. She was, she didn't identify. It was hard for her to say lesbian or anything because she was raised in Texas, and she went to some Christian school, college, she went to, I can't remember the name of it, and it was just not something that she was comfortable with talking about, nor did she really identify with feminism. And so that just killed me. I just wondered, but because she was just this woman who took care of herself, she had her own business, she was a florist and an artist, and then she moved to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which has this big gay community now, and lived there from the mid-70s until she died. And it was great because there was just, it was a lot of Vietnam War vets growing pot and other artists and people fixing up this little town that is so picturesque, and it's just beautiful. But, you know, somewhere during that, I had that memory of my mom saying that about queer and realized, God, she was protecting her sister who... she was not a part of our lives, really. I mean, like I say, growing up, I saw her maybe three times because family wasn't important to her because she didn't have family. And I'm sure she created her own family like we did in Roanoke. It was not part of their, what they knew how to do or be, or, you know, she didn't care that much about her sister or her sister's kids.
So do you think that helped when you came out to, like, your mother and your family?
Well, it was funny because when I came out to them, I lived in Roanoke for a while, and another friend of mine and I decided that we were both going to come out to our parents while we went home for Christmas. And I don't remember what year it was, but it was after my accident, I'm pretty sure. And so Christmas came and went, and I remember I went into the kitchen, my mom and dad were in there, and I said, oh, there's something that I want to talk to you about. It's okay. And my mother was stirring some batter, which is not like she was Betty Crocker or anything, but at that particular time she was making something. And I said, I just want you to know that gay. I just started sobbing, and I thought, what is the problem here? Because I wasn't sorry. I was happy about it, but I was so scared and everything. And my mom just started stirring faster and leaned in a little bit. My father said, we knew. Like, oh. Oh, well, then I stayed for a couple more days. It was pretty funny. But that was sort of the end of it. And, you know, then I was always bring my girlfriends home and stuff like that. But it was sort of a non-event. And I felt like I could come out to them at that point because I knew that if they disowned me or if it just went south, I had a family here. And so I was safe, and I didn't need them anymore because I had my own first Friday.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more about the difference, like the cultural difference you felt when you came here. Like you mentioned that everyone was like really closeted, and that seemed sort of different to you?
Yeah, it was. Nobody talked about it. Nobody talked like the softball players. Nobody talked about being together or anything. You know, you knew that people were paired up, but it was so hidden. Especially if it was two members of the same team or something, and I was all like, "Hey, this is great for Louis Mans, right? We're the best. We're superior." But that wasn't how people felt. And really, my best friend, who we'll call A, she and I had that in common. I don't know if she would have called herself a feminist at that point, but she certainly was, and we were happy with who we were, you know. And now I couldn't come out at work. I still, you know, couldn't do that because I was so afraid that I would be fired. You know, that would be the worst possible thing to happen, would be for me to lose my job. And that was sort of the only reason that I could come up with that I could lose my job. The cultural difference. There was not just a group of lesbians who did other things. It was all, I later heard that there were some, like, professors and stuff at Hollins or wherever, you know, and they would get together, but that, I had no access to that, you know, to those people. And so the only people that I knew were these softball players, were all these jocks, and there was, they weren't feminist, they weren't comfortable with themselves, and yet, you know, they were, you know, working jobs. Like, it was a time when women were entering the work field, and so, like, there was a police officer, you know, and I don't know what all they, so the people did. A lot of people just had blue collar jobs. But they had no affiliation or affinity to women's liberation or the feminist movement. And so when First Friday started getting together, everybody was feminist, you know, and it wasn't something that we talked about because First Friday wasn't a political organization at all. And that was okay because I think its mere existence was political. So that's the cultural difference. And also, again, the Yankee thing, which didn't really mean much to me, and then I would hear things like, you know, the War of Northern Aggression. I'm like, oh my God, these people are still fighting the Civil War. And for me, it was like a paragraph in my history book in fifth grade. You know, it meant nothing to me. So there were those kind of cultural differences. And I was loud, and I didn't behave the way a lot of Southerners felt women should, you know, be. I wore dresses, and I loved, you know, just dressing up for work and doing my thing, but, yeah.
All right, so tell me about the beginning of First Friday.
Well, I get really confused about the very beginning of it. Because I was thinking that Taylor House was after we'd been doing stuff, but it wasn't. And so really, it was around at the Taylor House where we were getting together once a month, or you know, more often, but definitely the first Friday of every month. And sometimes women would play music, and mostly it was just a party, you know. There was always a lot of drinking going on, too. And when we had Barbara's 50th birthday party, and pulled it off, I mean, it was a big event, you know, and we got people from all over the state because Barbara was so old, she knew so many people. And so we just filled, people came from Richmond and Norfolk and probably the Outer Banks, in Lynchburg, and anyway, all came, everybody dressed up. I mean, you didn't have to twist anybody's arms or anything. We had, you know, fancy invitations for it, and we even had a fake birthday party for her the day before. So she wouldn't know that we were having this big surprise party for her. And so once we pulled this off with aplomb, we thought, hey, what else can we do? You know, there's just, and so we would just have these ideas, and, you know, somebody had an idea about the retreat, and it was like, yeah, that would be fun. And everybody had different skills that they brought to the table, and it all just kind of worked together. And from whether it was theatrics or cooking or, you know, electrician or, you know, directing people where to park. You know, I mean, like, everybody just took on different roles, and it was a ton of work. Like, I don't remember the retreat so much because I was working the whole time. And I think you'd hear that from a lot of the organizers. And that's okay. I mean, this is what we wanted to do. And so we pulled off that first one, and it was little and sweet, and boy, let's do this again. And it just grew and grew. And word of mouth, you know, we also sent out flyers and stuff. And before Skip Two Periods, you know, it was pretty much just a mailing list where we would send the retreat flyers to people. But then we started compiling, you know, this pretty big mailing list and decided to, we need a newsletter. So we did a newsletter. And again, everybody contributed what they could, from doing research to laying the paper out, because it was way before computer stuff. I mean, everything was done with an X-Acto knife and wax and lining it up and all that. It was pretty primitive, you could say. But we did it, and they looked good. And Anne did, it came up with a masthead that was beautiful and all the little drawings in it. And, you know, she added so much to the look of First Friday, you know, and how we presented ourselves to the world. And it was really important to us that we looked professional, and that, because we were, you know, and so we were very careful about all the details. And we always went out of our way when we would produce concerts or theater or whatever to treat the artist as best as we possibly could. And at that time, there were a lot of musicians traveling around the country doing women's concerts, and they would be thrown, you know, like, okay, well, there's a futon over there, and there's around the corner is a restaurant. You know what I mean? Like, not treated like they were stars, and we treated them like they were stars, you know? We were celebrating ourselves and them and our culture. Yeah, how did First Friday start? It was conversations, and wouldn't it be fun if? And then we just did it, you know? And we would have meetings. We would have meetings throughout the week, probably, but definitely once a week on, you know, people's porches and in living rooms and stuff. There wasn't a lot of fighting or jockeying for position or power plays, which was really cool. I mean, there were some bossy people in it, and I would be one of them, and Nancy would be another. And Brahoni, I mean, like, it was just, no, Brahoni's not bossy, but she's real smart and knows how to deliver a message well. Whereas if I disagree with something, I would be on my feet, and, you know, just. But there wasn't a lot of that going on. You know, there were a couple things, and I think that I was a big part of one of the issues that, in the moment, didn't seem that big of a deal, but then it came back to haunt us later, and I can hear myself saying it. And that was that in the retreat flyer, we were trying to decide about kids being there and stuff, and sometimes people want to bring their pets and stuff like that. So anyway, I'm like, no kids, no dogs. And that's what it said, I think. You know, sorry, no children, no pets, or something. But it was like people were mad about that. Like, mothers. Well, there weren't that many lesbian moms that we knew, and, like, who knew that lesbians had kids? I mean, it was just, it was wrong. I was absolutely wrong, and it never occurred to me, and I don't like dogs, so that's, I don't take that back, but I'll take the kids back. yeah. So other than that, pretty much, at least in the first bunch of years, everything just worked out the way the way it was supposed to, and we were all in it together, and we were all exhausted, and we all reveled in its success. And I think that made money sometimes, and that wasn't our, we didn't set out to make money, but we always just put it back into the next event.
How would you describe the demographics of the group?
White. I could name the number of black women, the African-American women that I can remember here. And I'm sure that they probably had their own social things that they did, because there had to have been more black lesbians, you know, I'm sure. But, you know, and none of them were really involved in the organizing, but like socially. And like I just saw some pictures from Barbara's birthday party, and I was like, oh, I haven't thought about her. And then she was with another woman who looked a little familiar, but I wasn't sure. So I didn't know either of their names, but yeah, it was very white. And pretty much we were all in our 20s or 30s. You know, there might have been, you know, a couple women who were a little older. But in terms of younger, you know, 20s-ish. Yeah, like right out of college.
So, what about, would you say that pretty much everybody identified as lesbian, or were there, like, bisexual women there as well?
No, because, I didn't want any bisexual women around. Now, you know, I've learned to accept them. But at that time, when you had so much at risk, you couldn't get involved and fall in love with a bisexual woman because she wasn't risking anything. She could just go back to being with a guy, and you'd be left brokenhearted. So it was an emotional investment, but it was also a commitment to taking care of each other and being there. And I didn't want anybody wishy-washy or involved in this. And really, there was not a bisexual movement as such, or bisexuals speaking up for themselves at that point. I think that came later. Like, at that time, it was probably just LG.
So, yeah. What was the group's relationship with gay men, or men in general, or attitude towards them?
I personally was a social separatist. I described myself like that forever. You know, if I had to be with men, which I did because I worked with men mostly, almost exclusively, and I could handle it and do it and all that. But I didn't want to waste any of my social time, my off time, being with men, nor did I want them infiltrating our group or our parties or our events. I mean, even if they would come to a concert or something, get out of here. You have every other place to go, you know? So, yeah, I was pretty adamant. I don't think that I represented everybody with that. A lot of people were nicer and more accepting, and just, you know, realize that we live in a world full of both men and women. But back then, you just kind of had to be protective and in extreme.
So tell me about the kinds of activities that First Friday did, other than, like, the retreat, I guess.
Yeah. Well, after Barbara's party, and we had so much fun, we decided to have more of these dances, these fancy dress balls. And I can't remember when the first fling was, so we started doing them in February, and it was First Friday's Fabulous February Fling. And we did them for years, all at the Roanoke County Women's Club. And I would MC it, and bands would play, and we would have a dance contest, and it was just a load of fun. We would have a lot of food, and people came to expect a certain level of entertainment isn't the right word, but just that the party was going to be, you know, really nice. There wasn't going to be a keg of beer, you know, there would be. And pretty much I think it was an open bar, I think. But I don't remember. There was certainly alcohol, but I don't remember if we provided it or not. I know that that came up with retreats, whether we would provide free beer, because we did for a long time. And there were some people who were really adamantly against it. And I don't remember which way it went. I think at some point we did stop having it free, but still people brought it. And we weren't saying no liquor, just that First Friday was not going to provide it. What else did we do? Well, the newsletter was a big thing because my outfielder and I laid it out for a long time, and that was a huge undertaking. And we also wrote a column for it, and that was fun. We were the Condor Sisters, and we wrote just like a gossip column, you know, using first names or initials. I think we used initials. And it was just silly as it could be, and never mean-spirited, but poking fun. And, like, never meaning to be mean. But, you know, but poking fun at people, you know, you have to be able to laugh at yourself. And, you know, we tried to include that, just poking fun at ourselves in it as well. And it was just, I was very influenced by a column in the Village Voice that I think it was Michael Musto. I think he took it. There was another one, and that guy died, and then Michael Musto had one. But I had been getting the Village Voice for years and years, starting in Milwaukee, and I just really liked that column. I would go to it every time, and I would read it along with all the other stuff. So I thought that that was very important for the paper. And that was my only contribution, was writing that column and then laying it out. But other people wrote thoughtful articles or researched articles or different things. Like there was a big article in one issue about Eleanor Roosevelt. And at the time, I had no clue that she was a lesbian or had a relationship with a woman. So that was kind of neat, because if I didn't know, then there were other people who didn't know. So that was, I think Nancy wrote that. And what else did we do? I mean, when I was in the hospital, people were awesome, you know, coming around and everything.
Well, going back to the Eleanor Roosevelt thing, actually, yeah. I did notice that there were a number of articles in Sketchy Periods about, like, history and lesbians in history. And plus, I know you guys had the Lesbian History Archives come to a retreat and everything. So I was just wondering how history, like, played a part in the group or in Sketchy Periods, or how it was or was not present in your mind.
Because we were pro-women and pro-lesbian, you know, we wanted to celebrate any lesbians. And so coming up with historical figures, because we didn't have too many role models, you know, or examples or people that we could even, like, disagree with, but they, well, at least she was a lesbian, you know what I mean? And so I think it was a way of trying to educate people about our ancestors, and also just interesting, you know, because there wasn't even women's studies then, you know, or much less gay and lesbian studies, or women's studies maybe were just starting to happen, I don't know, but it was, it really was a way of making the newsletter more valuable. I mean, so you can have a little gossip column. You can have you can have the directions to the next First Friday party, and whatever else we would have in there. But adding something historic like that gave it some meat, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. So describe the retreats for me.
Mm. We would get there early, maybe the day before. I can't remember, like maybe we'd get there on Thursday night or something, but we would work our butts off all day Friday getting ready for it. And the food committee was one of the most important committees. And so people would go and they would buy the food. And, well, I was never on the food committee, but I did enjoy it. So I know that they were very well organized and had people who were, well, first they would come up with the menu and then people would go to buy the food and then there was all the food preparation. We also asked everybody who came to the retreats to volunteer. And so they could volunteer for all sorts of things, and certainly working in the kitchen was one of them. And so it wasn't just First Friday people cooking, it was campers too. And some campers loved it and that's what they did every year. Or if there was somebody who was sort of by herself and didn't know what to do with herself, you know, it was maybe nervous. It's like, go to the kitchen, you know, because there would be music playing and people chopping and dancing. You know, it was just, it was a good time. So we had registration. People had to register in advance. I don't think that we necessarily had people come without registering, maybe we did. But we had people assigned to parking, so people would drive in, and somebody would be there to greet them, tell them where to park, and then they would go to registration and just get whatever they needed, like the stuff to make their name tags. And have you ever seen one of the name tags?
I don't think so.
They were, you know, little pieces of wood, you know, circles of wood from a branch and with a hole in it drilled in, and so tied with yarn, and then people would just decorate it in, with their name, you know, and you'd wear that all weekend. So you'd get your name tag situation. And then find a place to camp, or if we had a lot of buildings or whatever they were called, and then where you were assigned. And there was always at least one heated building, and the organizers got it. I mean, that's just how it was. So we would all try to leave work, you know, to take Friday off, whatever, to get there. And because there was just trash cans to be put out, and we would try to sweep out all the cabins and, you know, just little things, making sure that everything was taken care of, you know, deciding where the Olympics was going to be and making sure sound systems worked. And I always did an opening. The retreats opened with two things. First, Kathy Brahoney would come out and give a really soulful welcome to people. And she's great. She's a psychologist. She's so well-spoken and always just made everybody feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be right now. It was awesome. She didn't try to make jokes. She didn't try to do anything. But give this nice welcome and appreciate what we have and what we're doing. And, you know, it's lovely. And then she would introduce Sister Mary Catherine, and I would come out. And for Sister Mary Catherine, I spell Catherine with a C, so that would be Sister MC. That's my own little thing. And every year I would do it, and I had the same outfit, and it was really cobbled together. It was not in any way a real nun's habit, but I had all the right pieces because I had been, you know, all, for 10 years of schooling, sitting there looking at a nun teaching me. So I did have the right shoes for sure. And usually there would be some point that I would just pull myself away from what was going on with registration and just the activities of getting ready and sort of sequester myself to write what I was going to say. And it was really my responsibility to give out any rules. Like, you know, the one that people always remember is to trail strip your cigarette. And so, you know, and then because every year I would say it, I would always have to come up with different ways of telling people how to do it. So, you know, one year I had some dancers. And they had giant cigarette butts and they would trail strip. And see, people were willing to do it. All I had to do was ask them, and would you please be my dancers? And, you know, yeah, you know. So it was great. So it was things like that, you know, to be respectful of each other and, you know, not make a lot of noise. And when we leave, you know, it has to be clean and just all the boring stuff. But I would say it like I was, you know, like some sexually deprived old nun, you know. Mad and angry, and you know, it was fun. And I have had a lot of surgeries on my hip over the years. In one year, I was on crutches for the retreat. This was after my first go around. This was maybe 5 years in or something. And I just was not up for doing Sister Mary Catherine on crutches. I couldn't. I was like, and I started sort of putting it out there and seeing what people thought. And the backlash was incredible. I mean, like, clearly everybody wanted me to do it, but there was no way I could get them to understand that Sister Mary Catherine doesn't use, you know, and I have the Canadian crutches, which are like the polio crutches. You know, that's Catherine. That's Sister Mary Catherine. But I couldn't put weight on my leg for a year, and it was really important for me to adhere to that. So I talked with some of my buddies and said, I was thinking, could you make something like a booth, like the Wizard of Oz, but it would be Monster Mary Catherine. And so it would be on stage, and it would just be this giant nun head, and then the mouth would move. So I would be inside of it with a microphone doing the whole shebang with, you know, making it talk and all. And then at the end of it, somebody would come over and open it up like Wizard of Oz, and there I would be. And so that's what we did. And I mean, they made it. It was just beautiful. And maybe the eyes even lit up. I can't remember. I mean, we talked about that. I don't remember if it actually did. I have a picture of that.
I would love to see that.
And it was just amazing. To me, that is just the best example of people being willing to do just anything. All I had to do was ask them.
Oh my goodness.
Look at that. Paper mache head with a movable jaw.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, here's Pam working
on
it. Yeah, and Subi working on
it. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, I want to see these after we're done.
Okay. Yeah, this is who I interviewed while you were talking to Nancy.
Okay.
So people were always willing to do stuff. So they whipped the thing open, and then two people came up and grabbed me by the elbows and carried me to the microphone stand and put me in place. And then I talked as me for a little bit. But it was great because it was a way of almost saying goodbye to Sister Mary Catherine, even though I may have done it again after that. I probably did. But it was that to me. That was... the cherry on top for me. What was that? And so what else with the retreats? Well, we always had a named performer, a big name performer, open it. So Sister Mary Catherine would introduce the performer. And so one year it was Kate Clinton. And so I introduced Kate Clinton. She came up on stage and said, "How about that, Sister Mary Catherine?" And I whipped off my veil and went over and gave her a kiss. It was like so inappropriate for a celebrity, but it was still a moment in time I'll never forget. So then the performer would perform, and often they would stay for the weekend, which was nice. Kate didn't, but Split Bridges did, and different singers and comedians did. In that first retreat, we had the History Archives. I don't know if we also had a performance. I can't remember. So that would be Friday night, and there was always food available on Friday evening, you know, so people could eat first. And then on Saturday, we would have breakfast, workshops, lunch, I think some workshops, and then the Olympics. And the Olympics were, again, just the pageantry that we pulled off was amazing. We would always have a theme, and like one year was sports, and so we hit everybody, you know, we just told everybody, and the people who were in the parade were all the organizers, so they could get recognition, you know, like as it were. So like for the sports thing, everybody just had to come wearing, and somebody showed up in a wetsuit and flippers, and somebody else had a kilt on and a hockey stick. I mean, it was great. People just did it, you know, and it was like the one in the kilt, she worked for Ma Bell, you know, and she would go around to the different pay phones and stuff, or else she was installing lines. She was like people who you wouldn't expect to do something crazy like that. So that was really fun, and I would do a commentary of what people were wearing and stuff, you know, just to fill in. And then it would, you know, climax with Nancy coming out dressed as either a goddess, kind of a Greek goddess, carrying the torch and lighting, or carrying the flame and lighting the torch at the end. Or one year, the theme was water sports or something, and so she did it as a mermaid, and I made her a mermaid costume that was beautiful. She couldn't walk in it. But it was really well done.
Mermaids don't need to walk.
No, no. And one year the theme was old TV shows. And so I just brought all these costume pieces because they just didn't know what to do. And so I dressed somebody up like I Dream of Jeannie. And just dressed people up like different heroines on television shows. You know, it was Mary Tyler Moore with somebody throwing her hat up in the air the whole time. You know, different shows that meant something to us that, you know, we had grown up with or whatever. And so then after the parade, the games would start. And so the games, I never really was part of making up the games. That wasn't my strong suit. That was really more pageantry. But they were fun. They were all funny and silly. And sometimes they would require a bit of athletic ability, but pretty much not. I mean, they really were for everybody. And I know that one of the first years we did a frying pan toss. And I had brought my big black skillet in, and this woman who I'm going to interview tomorrow, who was a PE teacher in Roanoke, she threw that thing so far, and damn if the handle didn't break off, and I didn't have a pan anymore, but it was still so funny. And she kept that pan for years. I don't know if she still has it or not. But people would keep things like that. And then we had the award ceremony that night, before the dance, and the awards were, you know, as ridiculous as anything that we did. There was one that was pictures of Anita Bryant, because this was in the era of Anita Bryant, autographed pictures of Anita Bryant. I can't remember what that was for. And I don't have much of a memory of the prizes, except that people cherished them. They just loved them, and they kept them on their mirrors or wherever for years. And that was so cool. I mean, it made all of our work so worth it, that people had a good time and that they treasured this stuff. Mm-hmm. So then after the award ceremony, there would be a dance. So after the Olympics, it was probably some downtime, and then dinner, then the award ceremony, and then a dance. And the dance was a blast, you know. We would have some lights going, music. Then the next morning was breakfast and maybe some more workshops, and just winding down. And we always took a group picture. And so everybody would get together and, you know, put the cameras up, you know, and run back into the picture. And you couldn't tell who anybody was, but still, it was cool. And then people just saying goodbye to each other, and, you know, really, nobody wanted to really leave. It was always a long goodbye and a long drawn out leaving the camp. And we had to leave it. We wanted to leave it in better condition than we found it, always, just because that's who we were, and we wanted to make sure that everything was nice and that they couldn't throw us out for any other reason other than being lesbians. Hopefully they wouldn't find out. But that was the retreat, pretty much. And then there was this period leaving the camp, like once you got on the highway again, or you pass a 7-Eleven and just go, oh my God, you're back in reality. And so this magical world where you were safe, where you were respected and loved, and with people like you, was gone. And then you just were back to the same old thing, back to work the next day. You couldn't tell anybody what you did over the weekend. I mean, you could, I went camping. You know, I mean, there was just, unless you were out at work, and nobody really was. So
I think I remember that you had some struggles finding places to have the retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
I wasn't really involved with that. Yeah. I mean, I can share one story that and if Nancy had already told you to stop me, but another woman was going to go find a camp for us. You know, Gail was going to go find a camp, and she found one, and it was decided that we were just going to, because we had been kicked out of the first camp after being there twice for being lesbians, let's just tell them up front, and then, you know, we won't have to deal with it. And she, you know, went through the whole thing with the woman, oh, and by the way, we're a group of lesbians, and the woman said no. And just, we couldn't. And so, okay, we just moved on to the next camp. And talking to Gail, she said that, but now, 30 years later, I know this woman, and she's now in her 80s, and she's a big supporter of gay and lesbian rights and stuff. But, you know, at that point in time, there was no way. But I never was involved with the choosing of the camp.
Let's see. Do you remember the representative from the Lesbian History Archives coming?
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly did they do?
They had a slideshow, I remember. And I don't remember much of what was in the slideshow or what they talked about, but it was cool. It was more of that history, and it's like, oh, I didn't know that. And their whole reason for being there was to educate us about the archives, to stress the importance of saving stuff and how we're creating our history now, and it's really important to save it, and to stress that they needed money. And, you know, that's cool. We didn't really have any money to give them, but it was great because I think we all left there with an appreciation for the work they were doing. And then later, when a group of us went up to New York, some of them, you know, went and delivered a whole bunch of things, you know, mostly superiors, to the archives, which then your guy came across. So it's nice. It's nice to know that it's still being preserved and still there, all these many years later. That's about all I remember. I remember that I just thought what they were doing was really cool. But of course you keep everything. Just because I have files of stuff, you know. So not everybody necessarily does it. And now that I'm looking for things too, realizing that people, even if they had kept it, sometimes, you know, fire damage or just losing something in a move or, you know, flooding, you know, whatever, that stuff gets ruined and it's gone.
Mm-hmm. So what kinds of conflicts arose in First Friday?
I don't recall many conflicts. We pretty much got along. I mean, we would have little disagreements about things, but it was never like two sides of something and people were, you know. I don't remember any of that. I think later, as more people started coming in and the leadership changed a little, there may have been a little bit more in the way of conflict, but we all pretty much got along. Now, like once I remember at a fling, somebody telling me that so-and-so's back there, you know, bad-mouthing you. and I'm like, fuck her, tell her to get up here and be the MC. You know, it's like, but it never came, but I didn't like approach or say, what are you thinking? I mean, like, it was so stupid because I just thought, are you jealous? I mean, you can do it. You know, it's like we were all working so hard to make it happen and welcomed people joining us. And so, I mean, we certainly weren't perfect, and I know that I wasn't as sensitive as I have become in later in life, but I don't remember lots of conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So what were the gathering places that you used? Like, I know you mentioned Taylor House.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was also the Cornerstone, is that right?
Yeah, the Cornerstone was on, like, I think it says their 5th and Campbell or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a church, and at one point it was for sale or something, and some women invested in it and opened it up as a bar. Well, that was interesting because a lot of women wouldn't go to it because they'd been raised Baptist or whatever, and they would not go to a church to drink. So there was one of those cultural differences. Really? And it was a beautiful space, and and we had some nice concerts there and stuff. So that was a place. When we produced Split Bridges, we rented Arono College Theater, and it was really lovely. It was a great place. You know, in people's houses, you know, we didn't really... When we had a surprise birthday party for Alice, and that was downstairs at the park, because they have a downstairs bar. But we never really had meetings or gatherings or anything, any official First Friday things at the park or at any bars. You know, we'd go to McAdoo's, you know, a bunch of people would go out. But again, it wasn't necessarily a First Friday event, but it all kind of blended together. First Friday and your friends were all the same. So, yeah, then just different people's houses for the parties.
Mm-hmm. What were you aware of, like, the AIDS crisis going on at that time? Or did that affect it, you in any way?
It did not affect me in any way. And it was interesting. This is how it affected me. Because in 1981, I was lying in a hospital getting blood transfusions. And then hearing about this and wondering, oh, but it was fine because we were in Roanoke, and Roanoke was, you know, pretty isolated. I lost one friend to AIDS way later, and I had worked with him. He was an anchor man here in town. And then he left, and he was in D.C., that's where he died. But I'd kind of lost touch with him, and I had left Roanoke by then, so that it was in the 90s. But I personally did not, but I wasn't socializing with men, gay men, at all, really. And whereas some people who had lived here longer and they had friends, like my friend Alice, who was my best friend, she owned a t-shirt shop with, you know, a guy named Robert, and he was gay, and, you know, they did a lot of stuff together. So she knew more people. She may have known people who had died of AIDS, but I did not. And I've often sort of marveled at that wow, that was like this huge plague, and it just... Yeah, it didn't affect me at all.
I'm jumping around a little bit.
That's
now,
okay.
But was Butch Femme part of the First Friday culture at all, or were you at all involved in, like, Butch Femme stuff?
It was not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there were probably some people who came to the retreat that might have been more into that, but, like, in recent years where there's been a really... healthy Butch Femme culture developing among younger lesbians, and I've got a lot of friends in LA who are totally into it. I love it. I think that it's great, but at that time, those were old school lesbians. Those were, like, you know, really like butch dykes and their girlfriends who could pass, you know. And so when I was first coming out in Milwaukee at the bars, I would see these couples and I'd just giggle at them, you know, slow dancing to Barry White. These little hole-in-the-wall lesbian bars. But that was not part of my... my picture was probably pretty butch. But that wasn't part of the culture at all.
So what were, like, the markers of a lesbian at that time in your circle?
Yeah. You didn't really wear makeup. You didn't shave your legs. You didn't buy into Madison Avenue, the Madison Avenue woman. You know what they were trying to create, or have created, and continue to. You know, comfortable clothes. I mean, like, I would dress up for work. I would have fun. You know, and I'd wear heels, and I would, you know, do whatever. But and off hours. What else? I mean, our hair always sort of reflected what was going on in the bigger world. Like, it was the 80s, so everybody had big hair, you know? But it wasn't necessarily lesbian big hair versus straight woman big hair. There weren't any things like pinky rings or different things that had existed in other decades that, you know, was a clue, signal. Yeah, I can't really think of anything.
Yeah.
In Roanoke, I mean, because once you went to, like, New York, it was a whole different thing. And, you know, a bunch of us went to New York, and one of the things we did was we went to the WOW Cafe, and that's it stood for Women One World, and the Split Bridges women had started that. That was their performance space, and it was a gathering space. And there was Butch Femme going on, and lots of leather jackets of people, but that was even, you know, that's just sort of always been. But they were hipper. I mean, there was not a lot of style happening here.
Were there other lesbian communities or, like, gay communities in other parts of Southwest Virginia that you guys were interacting with?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I knew some women in Abingdon because we had moved down from Milwaukee at the same time and shared a U-Haul and stuff, and I dropped off their stuff in outside of Abingdon in Nicholsville, and then continued on. And in that little moment in time when I was there, I met a couple other lesbians who, in fact, gave me Alice's name. And that's how I met Alice, because they told me her name is Alice. She owns a t-shirt shop. And go, introduce yourself. And I was so scared. I went to that store like 4 times before I ever walked in it. And then when I walked in it, you know, I looked at all the t-shirts. And she said, can I help you? Well, actually. And she'll tell the story. I mean, it's just ridiculous how nervous I was and scared. And I don't know what I was scared of. I think maybe it was that if this didn't work out, then I really didn't know any lesbians. I didn't have any way. This was my one shot at meeting somebody.
So was she sort of your gateway to the lesbian community here, or?
Sort of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
She, like, already knew people, or?
Yes, she did. But, I mean, because she was a business person, she was really busy with doing that. And with the guy that she owned the company with, and it turned out that they lived around the corner from me, which in Old Southwest, which was pretty funny. I lived on Albemarle at the time, and they were literally around the corner, and so they were, you know, silk screening t-shirts, and, you know, just they had a couple locations, so there was a lot of work. And then you know, we just went to softball games and met people. But that was one crowd, and that was as much fun as it was, and as much as I would, you know, be in love with whoever I was seeing at the time, it wasn't First Friday. It was, it wasn't a group of friends that, you know, I didn't stay friends with the softball players or anything.
So, have your experiences since you left First Friday and left Roanoke changed the way that you look back on it at all?
Well, in one of those you don't know what you got till it's gone kind of ways, because I've never been in a community like this. Mm-hmm. I have a great group of friends in LA, because a woman that I had met 1975 lives there, and I ran into her right when I moved back, and she and her partner have included me in their circle of friends, and so we celebrate, you know, holidays together and, you know, things like that. But they all lived in LA for a lot longer, and I notice that every now and then that it's just a different thing. And they're all West Siders, which is, you know, most of them are, you know, attractive, they could pass, they, you know, they're not necessarily shouting out, hey, I'm a lesbian. I think that's great, you know. So that's the only community that I can think of that I can compare to, and it's not the same, you know, it's just not. But yeah, so it didn't it certainly contributed to my feeling that I can do anything I want, you know, and that I could call on these people if ever I needed to. I mean, Nancy and I didn't talk to each other for 30 years until in October, and boom. I mean, it's like we didn't skip a beat. You know, it's really, it's so comfortable and it's so nice. And, you know, she just brought her scanner and she's scanning all these pictures for me, you know, for the doc and stuff. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. All right. I know we've been talking for a while, but if you want to just give, like, a brief summary of, like, what you've done since you left Roanoke and what your life is like now.
Yeah. I left Roanoke to follow my girlfriend to Alabama, where she got a job teaching at the University of Alabama, and I ultimately landed a job in Montgomery working at Alabama Public Television. And so I would commute on the weekends. And then we broke up, and I'm not going to go into those details, doesn't matter. We broke up, and there I was in Alabama.
Ah!
So, even though I'd made some good friends there, so I started looking for work, and there was an opening in Norfolk, and I applied for that and badgered the guy till he hired me because Alice had moved there, and Kathy Brawny had moved there. Like, I had a lot of friends in Norfolk. So moved to Norfolk and worked there for a few years, and then finally followed my dream and moved to New York. But I was already in my 40s, and it's a sort of a younger women's town. I mean, not really, not like L.A., but I remember often wishing that I had been there sooner. So I was working for Time Inc. New Media. I was the production manager for this little, it was called the News Exchange, and we were working on an interactive television project that took place in Orlando, and we provided all of the news, the stories and the anchor people, and streamed it down to Orlando, and then that was the news portion of this experiment. And the experiment didn't work. There were a number of different companies trying things out, and so when this failed, then I was out of a job again. Like, damn. Well, that was the first time, I think, that I was laid off. Yeah. And so I had also been working with Dyke TV in New York. So I did some work for them. It's all volunteer. And I met a woman there, and we were seeing each other. And then she moved to San Francisco. So when I got laid off, it was December in New York, and all I heard was another beautiful day in San Francisco. Oh, Catherine, you should be here and stuff. And so I thought, what would be better, to be laid off in freezing New York in the winter or another beautiful day in San Francisco without a job? And I thought, I'll move to San Francisco. And packed up and moved. And the relationship did not work out. And nor did San Francisco work for me. Of all the places I've ever lived, that didn't work out for me. There was no jobs for me, even though I had all this experience. There just wasn't that much television happening. I got a job as a headhunter for software engineers, as if. And I would talk to them. I said, oh, so where are you from? Oh, you're from Michigan. Well, I'm from Wisconsin. I mean, like, I could talk, but I couldn't place anybody because I didn't know what the heck they did. Well, a network engineer versus a software engineer. It was pretty funny. So I visited some friends in L.A., and it was a no-brainer. It was beautiful here, there, and television was everywhere. And Anne, the artist for First Friday, was living out there then, and the woman she was seeing worked for one of the cable networks, and so she passed my resume around for me. So I had a bunch of interviews at this cable network, and within 2 weeks I had a job and moved down there, and that was in June of 97, so this is my 20-year anniversary in a place that I never thought I would be. So I worked for this cable network, E Entertainment Television. I worked for E for 13 years and rose through the ranks. I was a producer on True Hollywood Story, and then a supervising producer on the show, and then on other shows, and then I was director of production, and then I was executive director of production, and I worked on the Anna Nicole show, and when Anna Nicole died, I was the person they sent to the Bahamas for the funeral, and I mean, like, I was close to her, I knew her, and all that. And then in 2009, when the economy was still a mess, NBC Universal was about to buy E, and so they needed to look better on paper, so they laid 50 of us off. Then a month later, they let 50 more people go. So I was laid off from there in 2009, and in 2010 I got a job, a dopey little job, at Santa Anita Racetrack. Who knew they had a little television division? And I was the production manager for a little group of us. We were making documentaries about horses or horse people or owners or trainers or tracks or whatever. And then about 4 years later, there was another horse sports network that wanted to buy us out. And so they did, and we were all laid off. And that was a couple years ago. And so I've been laid off ever since. And now I'm 63 years old. Nobody's going to hire me, even though I've got all this experience and I'm a hard worker. So instead, I'm working on freelancing. And I've gotten a couple freelance jobs doing editing and shooting and whatever, and working on my passion project, which is a documentary about First Friday. So I'm so pleased at what you guys are doing, and it really kick-started it for me, because I was so excited that you guys were actually recognizing us and like we existed and you appreciate that. It was so great. And then, and I was high on that for about 2 weeks, and then I went, wait a minute, this is my story. And so I finally am doing this. It's something I meant to do for 20 years, but before people die or whatever, get rid of more of their ephemera, I'm here. And so it worked out well with this, and and so I've interviewed about 15 people now, and I've got more to go. So, and then the editing starts, and then that's when it's going to be really a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to end. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that we skipped?
No. Just thank you. Thank you so much for acknowledging us. It's great.
Thank you so much for existing.